required at saxsim.org.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. We're following the latest developments after shootings in the U.S. and Australia. And a measles outbreak in South Carolina has left hundreds of people quarantined. Find out more. Plus, we put on for our cities today with legendary rapper Jeezy. He talks about his new show that mixes hip-hop with an orchestra.
We're breaking the veil on this. Like, when you think about classical music, what do you think about? Like, we're in it now. It's like seeing the brothers on the golf course. It's like, uh-oh.
It's Sunday, December 14th. News and headlines are next.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Health has suspended and revoked the license for the Brainerd Assisted Living Facility Carefree Living. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the health department has conducted numerous investigations into the facility and found it was not in compliance with several state regulations and laws. These include neglect of residents, improper or lack of documentation for medications, procedures, and more, and not following through on correction orders. Brainerd Carefree Living is owned and operated by Oxford Living, a division of Spectrum Health Companies, which has 10 other Carefree Living facilities in Minnesota. The dispatch's attempts to reach company officials for comments were unsuccessful. The suspension is in effect immediately, but the facility is required to ensure residents receive necessary care until they are safely transferred elsewhere. The health department notes Brainerd Carefree Living can appeal the temporary suspension. The Nisswa City Council is taking steps to possibly seek a vote of no confidence or censure its mayor. The Echo Journal reports Mayor Jennifer Carnahan did not attend a special council meeting Wednesday that was specifically called to discuss her conduct. Carnahan has accused a Nisswa resident of assaulting her outside the Pickle Factory, the city's municipal bar, during the City of Lights event in late November. Prosecutors have declined to bring charges against the resident twice. Before the incident, the resident had raised concerns about Carnahan making disparaging comments about City Councilmember Jesse Zahn loudly in public. Councilmember Bruce London said the incident was the latest in what he described as a year of drama and conflict. In that year, the city has lost its administrator and clerk, and two interim administrators left within a matter of weeks. Carnahan was elected mayor in 2024. She is the former chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, where she was similarly accused of creating a toxic workplace environment. Months into her stint as Nisswa mayor, she also ran for the open seat in the Minnesota Senate created by Justin Eichhorn's resignation. Carnahan issued a statement following the meeting describing it as political theater and saying she would not be bullied into resigning. She says, quote, "No evidence of wrongdoing was presented, no specific code violations were identified before the meeting was called, and no due process was offered." The council intends to continue its discussion at its meeting on Tuesday. Minnesota students reported being less depressed in 2025 than in recent years, but a majority still say they'd recently felt anxious and on edge. This is according to the Minnesota Student Survey released Tuesday by the Minnesota Department of Education and other state agencies. The optional survey is administered to 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th graders every 3 years in public school districts and charter schools. The Minnesota Reformer reports students also reported stronger connections to their schools and other improvements in overall well-being. The findings offer some hope that the decades-long decline of teen mental health, particularly acute during the pandemic, could be turning around. Students have also stopped vaping so much. Less than 8% of juniors this year reported vaping in the 30 days before taking the survey, compared to about a quarter of them in 2019. The survey's accuracy may be limited, however. Less than half of Minnesota students completed it, and the survey has become divisive in recent years for asking students about their drug use, sexual activity, and gender orientation. Some school districts have chosen to opt out altogether. A new study from the University of Minnesota has found that several species of parasitic fungi were effective at killing emerald ash borer beetles. The beetles are one of the most devastating forest pests to ever hit North America. The tool is called the auto-dissemination device, which traps beetles and coats them with spores of insect-killing fungi. Once covered in spores, the beetles can fly out of the trap and spread spores to one another through mating. Decades of research have gone into developing ways to control emerald ash borer. Ash trees are important in urban areas where they can comprise up to 20% of the urban forest, but they are also a dominant tree in the state's northern marshlands. The university says tools like this one are needed to protect ash trees in these remote areas where other forms of management are less feasible. The researchers are now testing the four most successful fungal strains in devices placed at sites across state parks and forests. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Hundreds remain in quarantine in South Carolina as a measles outbreak accelerates. There have been over 100 confirmed cases of the disease in the state so far, and many more who could have been exposed. At the same time, a smaller outbreak continues along the Arizona-Utah border. Joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Carlos Del Rio. He's a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Emory University School of Medicine. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Aisha. How are you?
I am good. Measles is highly contagious, obviously, but it's also preventable. What's driving these outbreaks?
Well, Aisha, as you said, measles is one of the most contagious infectious diseases. One person infected with measles infects probably another 16 individuals or so. Mm-hmm. So clearly, 9 to 18 could be infected. So clearly, this virus also is transmitted through respiratory droplets. The virus stays in the air. So if I have measles and I'm in a classroom and I leave, the virus stays in the air for several hours so other people can come in and get infected. You are infectious several days in the order of, 4 days before you have rash or symptoms and 4 days after the onset of rash. So a kid can be feeling totally fine and still be infectious and will get sick later. So if your vaccination rates drop, and they don't need to drop a lot, we need to keep vaccination rates in the population above 95%. And the moment you start dropping below 95%, you start seeing outbreaks happening,
Is that what happened? Because just 25 years ago, the U.S. was declared functionally measles-free due to vaccination efforts. Like, what went wrong? Like, how do we get to where we are now?
Well, there's been a lot of doubts about vaccines. And what happens is we're victims of our own success, right? Mm-hmm. Measles vaccination eliminates measles. People don't see measles anymore. So they start asking, why do I need the vaccine? And at the same time, you have all sorts of, misinformation out there saying, well, the measles vaccine is associated with autism, which is not. The measles vaccine is not good. It's better for kids to get measles, which is absolutely wrong. So you start getting misinformation. So parents start saying, well, why should I vaccinate my kids? So again, you don't need a lot of kids to not be vaccinated. It needs to drop just a little bit. And the moment you start seeing that drop, you start seeing cases. South Carolina, for example, that is having a major outbreak right now, their estimated vaccination percent among school-aged children, it's about 92%. So it's not very, very low, but you have to bring it up. Mm-hmm. And if you bring it up, then it's a different story. But if you don't bring it up, then you have a problem.
Well, what do you make of the current state of vaccination? Because as you mentioned, yes, there has been a lot of anti-vaccine misinformation. It was in opposition to the COVID-19 vaccines during the pandemic. But lately, the opposition has seemed to spread to all vaccines. So what do you make of this moment that we're in?
Well, I'm I'm very, very sad and disappointed as an infectious disease physician. I really don't like to see diseases that could be eliminated, right? Measles is a disease that we can control. We can get rid of. We can be the Americas at some point in time was measles-free. The U.S., you know, we had vaccination programs, but now we're having all sorts of things like, you know, not having vaccination mandates at schools, doing this, doing that. And that is just a little bit is necessary. If you're permissive and you start dropping rates of vaccination, you start seeing outbreaks happening. And unfortunately, you know, this is very sad because we could eliminate these diseases. We could control them. There's no point on having kids get measles. And again, measles, when you get infected with measles, natural measles is not a benign disease. We need to remind people that before we had vaccines in the United States in the 1950s, there were about 4 million cases per year. And out of those 4 million cases, there were about 500 deaths. You know, you talk about 500 children that died unnecessarily. Even in the current outbreak we're having in the U.S., close to 2,000 cases, there have already been 3 confirmed deaths. That's unacceptable. We shouldn't have healthy children die.
You're a practicing physician and an educator. Have you changed how you talk to your own patients or students about vaccination?
Oh, very much so. I really want to emphasize the importance of vaccines. And it's not just the measles vaccine. It's all other vaccines. You know, we see there's changes in the hepatitis B vaccine, another fantastic vaccine. There's a herpes zoster vaccine for adults. There's a human papillomavirus vaccine that will prevent girls, you know, from getting cervical cancer. We have vaccines that have been one of the greatest advances of science and which really have made an impact on infectious disease. And for me to see those vaccines being not utilized, it's really disappointing. And, you know, again, a country like the U.S., which has access to vaccines, which is wealthy, should not be seeing that.
That's Dr. Carlos Del Rio. He's a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Emory University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do so.
Early last week, President Trump announced a $12 billion plan to help farmers across the country. The Farmer Bridge Assistance Program is a one-time payment meant to help farmers make it to the next growing season. Black farmers represent less than 2% of all growers, and under the Trump administration, programs designed to help support them have been cut. The Gulf States Newsroom's Drew Hawkins went to a meeting of black farmers to find out how they've been affected this year and if the relief, when it comes, will be enough.
Coffee's worn off, the liquor's still kicking in, let's go, stand up.
The National Black Growers Council's annual meeting kicked off this week in New Orleans, just a few days after the Trump administration announced billions in tariff relief funding. James Davis drove down from North Louisiana. He's a third-generation row crop farmer, and he calls the Trump administration's program a bailout and says that even with it, some farmers may still go out of business.
It's not enough. Farmers gonna still need more. I hope and pray that it's enough to keep farmers in business because some of us have bigger debts than others.
Many of the farmers here say they've been hit really hard this year. Finus Stribling III farms 800 acres in Tennessee and Arkansas. He says 2025 was another year of what he calls farming in a deficit, one that got off to a rough start.
We had weather challenges. You know, early on we had a lot of rain, you know, trying to get in the field, and then kind of after all the rain, we got into a drought situation. So that kind of got us off to a fairly slow start.
Along with weather challenges, the Trump administration's tariffs, followed by other countries placing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods, mean farmers haven't been able to export their commodities, making it harder to secure loans many farmers take out to get their crops in the ground that they'll have to pay back once they get those crops out of the ground.
You say $12 billion seems like a lot of money, but when you look at the cost of production and the type of, you know, money that's spent in agriculture, I mean, $12 billion really just a drop in the bucket. You know, it's almost like putting a bandage on a bullet wound, you know.
For many farmers here, the politics behind the tariff relief don't really matter. P.J. Haney, a fifth-generation row crop farmer, is chairman of the National Black Growers Council.
We all have to eat. Whether you're Republican, whether you're Democrat, whether you're independent, we all have to eat.
Haney, like many farmers here, says he's grateful for any support. The one-time bridge payments are set to be delivered at the end of February next year, but he worries the relief won't come soon enough.
Our landlords want their money by the end of the year. Our bill
you know, our seed and input and chemical and equipment comes. We have to make payments by the end of the year. This needs to show up like Santa Claus underneath the Christmas tree, to be honest with you.
In addition to weather and tariffs, black farmers have faced additional challenges, Haney says. They make up less than 2% of all growers, and their numbers and the size of their farms have been shrinking.
In 1920, there were 1 million black farmers in this country. In present day, there are less than 10,000 black row crop farmers in the U.S. Black-owned land 100 years ago was 16 million acres. Present day, it's only 2 million.
And this year, the Trump administration dismantled decades-old USDA programs designed to assist black farmers by eliminating the socially disadvantaged designation, including programs like the 2501 program, which many black row crop farmers rely on for access to credit, technical assistance, and other support.
The black farm, row crop farm community needs the support of the administration. We need the support of program participation. We need the set-asides to make sure these families can stay in business.
And while the farmers here welcome the bridge payments, agricultural economists say the challenges farmers are facing go beyond 1 year of relief.
There's still just so much uncertainty with the trade picture.
Joseph Glober is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. He says smaller farms especially, like many black-owned farms, may not get as much relief from federal programs.
And the way the farm programs work, I mean, let's be frank, they are largely tied to areas, planted area. And so if you're a larger farm, you're going to get more in terms of government subsidies for any of these packages.
New trade agreements with China, historically the top buyer of American row crops like soybeans, may help improve the bottom line for U.S. farmers, Glober says. But they'll now also have to compete with other countries that have ramped up production. So many row crop farmers are looking at next year with a lot of uncertainty, like John Lee II from Arkansas.
What do we do in 2026 when we go to the bank to try and get along? What crops do we raise? So I'm concerned about the notion of going to the bank this upcoming year and not being able to get a loan because we can't make the loan cash flow. That's a big concern.
For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Watermark Arts Center Bemidji invites you to Intercultural Creative Circles on most Wednesdays now through March from 11 to 3. Bring your current art project or start a new one with your own materials. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps people-powered radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. And don't forget to visit our website, KAXE.org, for the latest Bright Spot, Set List, Up North Report, and Area Voices.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Following an overnight manhunt, police in Providence, Rhode Island now say they have a person of interest in custody. In their investigation into yesterday's mass shooting at Brown University, two people were killed, nine others were injured. In Australia, authorities have declared the Bondi Beach shooting a terrorist attack. Police say a large crowd had gathered to celebrate a Hanukkah event when two gunmen opened fire. At least 11 people were killed and 29 others injured. An American skier, Lindsey Vonn, came in fourth today in a World Cup Super G at St. Moritz on Friday. Vonn became the oldest World Cup winner at age 41. She came in second in a downhill event yesterday. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. At least 11 people were killed and several others wounded in a mass shooting in Sydney, Australia. Two gunmen targeted a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach and caused hundreds to flee the highly populated area. One of the alleged gunmen was shot and killed. The second has been arrested. Officials are calling the shooting an act of terrorism. Chris Minns is the premier of New South Wales, the state where Sydney is located.
This attack was designed to target Sydney's Jewish community on the first day of Hanukkah.
Joining us now from Sydney is Katie Silver, who's been following the story. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, what can you tell us about the shooting at this point?
Well, the scenes are really horrific. Bondi Beach is a very popular tourist and local spot, particularly Sunday evening, early evening, summertime, just before 7 o'clock local time at night. And the two shooters basically got on this bridge that goes above, it's a pedestrianised area. We understand there was 1,000 people there for this event. It's called Hanukkah by the Sea. From the pictures I could see, there was a lot of white deck chairs laid out on the lawn for them to be able to sit there and enjoy the event, a very important event in the Jewish calendar. And that's when these gunmen held fire. So we understand as well that one has been named. He is from a different part of Sydney. And we understand as well, sources have told the ABC in Australia that his home has been raided as they try and uncover exactly how this occurred and what went wrong. Police have said that one of these attackers was known to them, but the other wasn't.
Can you share anything about the victims or the condition of those who are injured?
So as you say, dozens injured, about 29 in total. We understand two of them were police officers that were shot, and there is a child amongst them. Now, somebody said that the hospitals, they've been taken to nearby hospitals. Somebody described the scenes at one of them as being like a war zone. Some people are in critical condition. The hospitals are overwhelmed. There's ambulances on the scene and families waiting to learn the outcomes for many of the injured. Now, from the footage that has been released, it's clear that they were aiming for this specific event, but it does appear as well that the gunfire was somewhat random. And in that sense, it could well be Jewish people as well as those who just happened to be in Bondi. But yes, it is likely to hit the Jewish community harder.
Well, Australia has enacted strict gun control laws. Just how rare are mass shootings in this country?
Incredibly rare. So the last time there was a mass shooting in Australia was in 1997. We had a gunman released fire on in an area called Port Arthur. It's a historic town on the state of Tasmania, and dozens were killed. And as a result of that, they enacted huge sweeping gun reforms, which are largely credited with reducing the incidence of mass shootings. It's very hard for people to own and to obtain firearms in Australia. The licensing is very, very challenging. And as a result, this is a very surprising event for many people.
Yeah, so do we know any more about the gunmen involved?
As I say, one has been labelled, but the authorities haven't yet labelled the other. The one that is being held under arrest, he is in critical condition, and we expect more information to come out in the coming days. There is a chance as well. Authorities haven't ruled out there might be more people involved.
That's Katie Silver, a reporter based in Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier this year, the
average price of a new vehicle hit a new record, eclipsing $50,000 for the first time. The Trump administration blames it on rising fuel efficiency standards and the push to adopt EVs. But there are lots of other factors at play, including tariffs on imported cars and car parts. So what's really behind the rising prices? And can anything be done to reverse the trend? Joining us now is David Welch. He's the Detroit Bureau Chief for Bloomberg and reports on the automotive industry. Thanks for speaking with us, David.
Thanks for having me here today.
So let's start with fuel efficiency. President Trump wants to roll back Biden-era regulations. He says it would save buyers about $1,000 per car. Are these environmental regulations really a big factor in making cars more expensive?
They played a role over the past decade or two as companies had to meet these regulations. They did put in things like turbochargers, which, you know, that can add a few hundred dollars to the cost of a vehicle. Hybrid systems, they can cost $1,000 or $2,000 more. And, you know, the companies try to recoup that cost with their sticker prices. So that's a piece of it. Now, the other part of it, though, is as companies have been able to meet their fuel economy regulations with some of that technology in larger vehicles, they canceled a lot of the smaller, cheap vehicles that they used to have to sell in order to meet their fuel economy rules. So things like the Chevy Cruze Compact, the Ford Focus, the Honda Fit.
They don't make the Honda Fit no more. That was my first car.
They don't sell it here. all these vehicles are gone. And, those were the vehicles that were, you know, years ago, 12,000, 14,000, or under 20. There are very few vehicles in that $20,000 range on the market these days. And that's one of the reasons that average cost is over 50,000. It's an average. So when you take out a lot of the cheap vehicles people used to buy at the bottom of the market, then you have this imbalance. But some of that technology, also safety technology, and a lot of infotainment stuff, creature comforts, all that stuff costs money. And it has pushed the price up. That's not the biggest factor that has made cars expensive, but it is a factor.
What is the biggest factor making cars so expensive?
So look, we've seen this run up in vehicle prices over the past 5 or 6 years. So what happened during that time? We had COVID and we had a semiconductor shortage. Both of those things caused automakers to have to cut production or stop production in some cases of vehicles. During COVID especially, we had plant shutdowns for weeks on end. The semiconductor shortage, they were having to allocate chips around to make their vehicles, that cut production. So the car companies learned something very important to them and their shareholders during this time period. What they learned was that if they made fewer cars, either because they didn't have chips or because they didn't have people working because they had COVID or because they just made fewer cars, they could charge more for them because dealers didn't have to negotiate. They didn't have to offer rebates and 0% financing deals and all that stuff. So, you know, back before COVID, we had annual U.S. vehicle sales of usually close to 17 million vehicles or more. Last few years, we're running, let's just call it, in the 16 million a year range.
And so are they still making the same amount of, not to cut you off, but are they still making the same amount of money? Like they're selling less cars, but they're making the same amount of money or more?
They're making more money.
They're making more. Okay, so that yes. Makes sense for them then.
Yeah, their profitability is much better these days. And if you get on their earnings calls, they will talk about, we had a good quarter with mix. What mix is, we sold more expensive cars than cheap cars in the quarter, and that's better for profits. Usually that means they sold more pickup trucks, more large SUVs than they did small SUVs. And the bigger the vehicle, the more expensive it is, and the higher margin they make on it.
Well, I mentioned the president's tariffs. Are they impacting car prices yet?
They have a bit, not as much as you would think. I think what we've seen is, you know, the average vehicle price has gone up $1,000 or $1,500 over that time. That's not, it is in excess of sort of the annual increase you would see in a healthy economy. They haven't been able to offset all of the tariffs is my point, but they've offset a little bit with some pricing moves.
Mm. Well, do you have any advice for prospective car buyers who might be listening? I know back in the day they would say, like, wait till the end of the year and, like, don't buy the new model year, buy the old model year. Is that still a thing? Are there any tricks?
Yeah, it can help a bit, particularly you're buying at the end of the month. Dealers often do want to clear out inventory, or they have incentive programs, so they'll bargain a little bit more. So, you know, be a smart shopper and do a lot of research and see if you can find a good deal out there.
That's David Welch, Detroit Bureau Chief for Bloomberg. Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you.
This year, the musician Natalie Payne crossed an item off her bucket list.
Going to Antarctica has been a long-term goal. It's something that I fell in love with as a child, and I remember my high school teacher telling me that Antarctica and music were not very compatible career goals, so I should probably try and pick one and stick with that instead. And music was my passion, so I picked music. But it's a dream I didn't give up on.
Natalie Payne plays the horn. Her big icy break came after years of playing in New Zealand's Royal Navy Band. She learned about an opportunity to be stationed at the New Zealand Defense Forces post in Antarctica as a communications operator. After applying multiple times, Natalie Payne got the green light. She packed her bags and, of course, her instrument and hopped on a flight to Scott Base in Antarctica. The internet is not always reliable down there, but Natalie was able to speak with us using a good old landline.
When I finally got to Antarctica and I got off the plane, I just could not believe I just took a second to look around and see the mountains and the ice, and I was carrying my little French horn with me. And I had just put my hands up in the air like, yes, I've finally made it. It's just the most wonderful sense of vastness. It's this huge expanse, and you can see so far away that it really is quite a trick on the mind that some of the things you can see in the distance are much, much further away. It is so much colder than I've ever experienced in my life. I grew up in Adelaide, where it was very like dry and hot in summer and cold in winter, but we didn't get much snow. So to come down here and experience true cold was something very different for me. It's also extremely dry because it doesn't precipitate very much. And so there's ice, but there's no rain, there's no running water. And you have to drink at least 2 liters of water a day, sometimes three, because you just get so dehydrated down here, which was something I didn't expect. The snow petrels that are down here, which I think are my favorite animal down here thus far. They're these beautiful little white birds that are so graceful in the sky. The Weddell seals, which are these huge fat seals with beautiful fur. They've got seal pups, which has been really, really cool. We also were really fortunate to be visited by some emperor penguins twice. I did think about grabbing my horn to play for some penguins when we saw some emperors a few weeks ago, but I didn't want to spook them because I've heard that if you spook them, they can get quite like shocked and go into shock and then they might die. And so I did not want to go around killing any penguins. Playing an instrument in Antarctica is really challenging. When I performed for the changing of the flag ceremony, I had to have two different gloves on my hands. I had like an inner layer that was quite thin of wool, and then I had hand warmers between that layer and my ski gloves, which were holding the trumpet. And even then, my fingers were freezing and my face was really, really cold, and just trying to keep my lips warm to play. So I had to make sure I didn't touch the valves too much so that I could make sure they didn't freeze, because obviously when you play a brass instrument, your breath forms condensation on the inside, and then the condensation in this environment can freeze. It occurred to me the other day that ancient horns were historically used for communication in the field until about the mid-1800s. And I'm down here as a communications operator and as a horn player, continuing this really interesting tradition in Antarctica many, many years on. You know, God works in mysterious ways, and I can't believe that I've been able to achieve both the career goal of making it as a professional musician and being able to come down to Antarctica. There's just this endless beauty to it. And for me, an underlying theme of just joy, humility, and thankfulness to God just for being here and the beauty of his amazing creation.
That's the musician Natalie Payne, who spoke to us from Antarctica.
Weekend Edition from NPR News. Two issues top voters' minds as Chileans go to the polls today to elect a new president: crime and illegal immigration. And in this runoff, voters face two starkly different choices: a lifelong communist or the far-right son of a former Nazi. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports that polls suggest the country may be poised for a sharp shift to the right.
A big crowd has turned out to hear presidential candidate José Antonio Kast in this conservative stronghold of Temuco in southern Chile. 40-year-old teacher Leslie Yaut says her city isn't the same as it used to be just a few years ago. We can't go downtown safely at night anymore, and the children don't play in the street like they used to, she says. She likes Kast's ideas on illegal immigration and crime, two issues Kast deftly conflates in his stump speeches. He's campaigning on an iron fist approach to crime, a message that's resonating in many Latin American countries. He's also vowed to deport the estimated 300,000 undocumented migrants in Chile, most from Venezuela.
Hay personas en mi patria que no duermen tranquilo. Hay personas en mi patria que tienen que dormir con un chaleco antibalas.
There are people in my country that can't sleep at night and wear bulletproof vests to bed, he says.
Y eso tiene que terminar. Esto no es venganza, esto es justicia.
This has to stop, and it's not revenge, he says, it's justice. He vows to increase police forces and build maximum security prisons. There's actually been a recent drop in homicides, says Claudia Heiss-Bendersky, a political scientist at the University of Chile. Despite that, though, she says Chileans feel vulnerable.
While we still have very low rates of homicide, we do have new kinds of crimes that we didn't have before, and I think that's had a lot of impact in public opinion.
Organized crime gangs have moved into Chile, trafficking everything from drugs to illegal wood, she says. And they hire assassins who use heavy weaponry to commit headline-grabbing graphic crimes. But today's vote is not solely ideological, she says.
We have an electorate that wants to punish elites and that wants to punish presidents in power. So it's a very strong anti-incumbent vote.
Chileans have opted for change at the top in nearly every election of the past two decades. That's a big hurdle for 51-year-old Jeanette Jara to overcome. She's a former minister in the outgoing leftist government and a lifelong member of Chile's Communist Party. At her closing rally this week in the capital, Santiago, she tried to focus more on policies that she says will work to help all Chileans, like a higher minimum wage, better pensions, and social programs to combat crime.
Tengo la convicción. Tengo la capacidad de tener mano dura.
I have conviction and the ability to take a firm hand when needed, she says. But while Jara came in first in a crowded field of candidates in the primary, she's now polling far behind Kast. This time around, he's avoided discussing his conservative stance on social issues. He favors a total ban on abortion, rejects same-sex marriage, and has spoken fondly about Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship, positions that tanked his previous two presidential bids. Roxana Munoz, a 58-year-old cashier, rejects Kast.
Jamás votaría por un hombre que habla tan mal de las mujeres.
I would never vote for a man who speaks so badly about women. He thinks we're just here to procreate, she says. With John Bartlett in Chile, I'm Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning to you on this Sunday. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and you're tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Lights in the Pines is a drive-through holiday light display at the Itasca County Fairgrounds in Grand Rapids. Hours are 5 to 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays, now until Christmas. After seeing the lights, you may park and explore North Pole Junction inside the fair's commercial building. The Park Rapids Area Library celebrates Yola Boca Flood December 15th through the 23rd. Check out any item and get a chocolate and a festively wrapped, gently used book. The Clearwater County Historical Society in Shevlin hosts the Festival of Trees. Enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are each weekend through December 21st. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Authorities in Providence, Rhode Island, and Sydney, Australia are investigating mass shootings today. Providence police said this morning they have a person of interest in custody in the shooting at Brown University. In Sydney, police say Australia's Jewish community was targeted by two gunmen. Another round of talks on ending the war in Ukraine. A series of meetings are taking place today and tomorrow in Berlin. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are there. In Indiana, quarterback Fernando Mendoza has won the Heisman Trophy as college football's top player. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. For over a decade, student test scores in the U.S. have been on the decline, and education researchers are in a desperate scramble to figure out why. One possible answer, the rise of smartphones and the amount of time kids spend staring at them. NPR's Sequoia Carrillo has more.
Martin West is a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, and he looks at a lot of data. He likes to keep an eye on how things are going for America's students. And a few years ago, he started to notice something. Test scores were falling off.
Actually, if you look at the data over the long term, it's very clear that the declines started prior to the pandemic.
There are several policy factors in the U.S. to consider, like a major change away from test-based accountability. But in looking at other countries, West saw a similar pattern of decline, even in places with wildly different testing strategies.
What is an explanation that can check all of those boxes?
One possibility West and others are exploring revolves around a cultural factor.
I'm 55 years old, and when my phone buzzes in my pocket, I have to resist the temptation to look at that text, right? Now imagine you're a 14-year-old.
David Faglio, a professor of economics at the University of Rochester, says this may be one of the culprits.
If we have these extremely addictive devices on our person 24 hours a day, or near us 24 hours a day, it stands to reason that this has to be one of the contributing factors.
Banning cell phones in schools has become a popular and bipartisan approach. At least 32 states now have some kind of restriction. Faglio and other researchers are scrambling to keep up. He's gathered data from a Florida district over the last 2 years. He says it's still too early to draw conclusions, but similar projects are underway around the country.
It's important for us to slow down, look at what the research is really saying about the impacts of cell phones on learning and well-being.
That's Kathy Doe, a researcher at UCLA's School of Education. She recently released one of the first national surveys on the impact of cell phone bans.
Oftentimes, these policy decisions are ahead of the science on this issue, especially looking at the impact of cell phone bans in schools, like the actual policies themselves.
Her survey focused on the need for building healthy digital habits and how cell phones are a distraction when not used intentionally for instruction. But in some classrooms, phones can be a learning tool.
It's more nuanced. It's not all bad.
She says schools shouldn't be afraid to reimagine or change their policies as more research comes out. All three researchers agree there's no one-size-fits-all approach to cell phones. And as much as legislators may want this to be a quick fix, the researchers say it's still too early to tell. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
Many years ago, rapper Young Jeezy dropped his album Thug Motivation 101. Man, and became a premier force in hip-hop. To celebrate the anniversary of that album, Jeezy, a.k.a. Jay Jenkins, wanted to do something a little different. A tour capped off by a residency in Las Vegas, accompanied by a 101-piece orchestra. Joining us now is the man himself, Jeezy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. That was a great intro.
Yes, I was definitely dancing. I love all of them. What made you want to revisit Thug Motivation 101 all these years after it came out? Because it was a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it like I'm definitely a wine connoisseur, an art connoisseur. I think art, wine, and things that are great like that get better with time, you know? And I felt like 20 years of this album feeling like it's fresh, it had to be celebrated, right? And then at the same time, you take it to the next level.
That's why you brought the symphony in it, to give it like a different feel to it, because you are officially a Guinness World Record holder for largest orchestra for a hip-hop concert. So we heard a bit of And Then What at the top of the interview, but I want to play the live orchestra version this time. Bringing in the symphony add to the show?
The first thing is, I can't speak for everyone, but I know my first time ever seeing a symphony and an orchestra was the first time I performed with one. So I wanted to take that experience around the world, because there's a lot of black and brown boys and girls and adults that haven't even seen this experience ever. And then the second tier, that would be just really showing culture that you can evolve. You don't have to stay in this box for people to accept you. You can be creative, you can be innovative, you can think outside of the box, and that's okay. It's always the stigma that there's, you know, violence around it, there's negativity around it, and this is the exact opposite. There's light around this, there's celebration around this, there's people that's coming on couple dates. Like, this, you know, this is date night, you know what I'm saying?
You also found time to put out a studio album this year with DJ Drama. It's called Still Snowing.
Still Snowing,
which is a reference to one of your nicknames, the Snowman.
Snowman, that part.
Well, what are the vibes on this record?
This is probably one of my most creative years. DJ Drama, if you know anything about my career, has been a part of my career since the beginning. We put together a project called Still Snowing. And this project, to me, is more of a passion project. But it's where I'm at. It's my truth. I like old school music.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking about Sounds of Blackness, Head to the Sky, you got 70s and 80s samples. And these are the actual songs. You got Tony Braxton, another sad love song. Martin Luther King will be down to walk. I wonder if Oprah be down to talk before another mama baby be lying to talk.
And that's different from kind of the southern trap rap we used to, trap music. What made you want to switch it up like this?
I don't think it's switching it up. I think it's in my truth. I hear people all the time saying, why don't you do that anymore? But like, I got, you know, I got a discography of, you know, 20 projects like that. You can go listen to that all day.
Yeah.
And the vibration where I'm at, where my spirit is, I'm on things that I connect with. And this is my truth. Like, I sit around the house and listen to this music. And this is a different, you know, sound from what I would normally do. But this is for the grown and sexy. First they love me, then they hate me, then they love me, then they hate me. Whole rowdy ride is talking about they wouldn't date me. You know how much, what did I get wrong? Y'all motherfuckers mad at the guy I picked wrong. My motherfucking record been impeccable this long. I know a gang of dangers, y'all should question the list long. And ever since that OK feature, the list long. And y'all would rather judge another cousin, cousin never was a sucker, sucker.
I interviewed Pusha T a couple years ago, and he said something that stuck with me. Like, he called himself the Martin Scorsese of street rap and the Dr. Seuss of cocaine. I hear you talking about how this is art, but, you know, like, so many times, hip-hop is not put in that same category as art. And what Pusha was saying was, he's a storyteller. And is that how you see yourself
I see myself as an urban philosopher. I never looked at this as music. I looked at this as leadership, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not what you say, it's what you do. My words match my actions. This is how I'm living. This is what I'm doing. And to double down on that, I feel that, you know, we're all poets. We just pick certain soundtracks to go behind the stories and the words that we're putting together. Mm-hmm. But it's all poetry.
Because, I mean, obviously, when you talk about snow and snowman, there is the drug game reference. So you talk about trap music. Is that right. Like a metaphor?
For me or them?
It was life for you, but is it a metaphor for the audience? Because yeah. I may feel it as I'm, you know, in my minivan, you know, driving my kids, but that's not my life. You know what I'm saying?
But I feel like deep down inside, we all trappers because we want more. We get out and we strive every day. We just get up and, you know, do the best we can. Yeah, it's still snowman because that's who I am. It's snowman forever.
But that's not about the occupation. That's about what it represents, the hustle.
The hustle, right. The hustle, but turned entrepreneur.
Yes.
I'm just bringing up all of my next life. Spend a couple mil on my next wife. Flocked it, nah, I ain't that tight. Dogs won't hit on the six. Long as it's rap tight. What I look like living a rap life. Put it, die every day. Real, is that right? I'm just trying to take care of my folks. These terrorists ain't no joke. On this red wine, trying to cope. It's the first of the
on this song, like, you're referencing how things have changed. Like, you, like, back in the day, I might have been in here with the kilo. Now I'm in here in a different way.
I'm saying the default. Now you catch me with on the beach with a default. That's a Cuban cigar.
Back then, catch me at the spot with a kilo. Nowadays, catch me on the beach with a default. Ain't no party like a snowman party at a snowman party. Ain't no baby oil, just red wine.
To me, snowman party is that. It's like, ain't no baby oil, just red wine. Like, we living over here. Like, we not tripping. This is my life. I don't got no problem saying that. Like, there is a such thing called a soft life. My life has been hard for 48 years. You know what I'm saying?
So
trying to live that life where I can actually have experiences with my family, or I can turn my friends on to things they never seen. I can take them places they never even heard of. I can uplift the people that are around me, that are in my circle, as we're building this empire.
It's telling people you live in life how you living now, right?
Right. And I get it. And I get it, because people are like, I ain't there yet. But this is what I will say. I don't know how many Jay-Z songs I listen to sitting on my auntie's front porch trying to figure out how to get out of there. But all I know is he said he was drinking Cristal, and that's what I wanted to drink, so I had to figure it out. That inspired me. And I had no idea what it looked like, what it was going to taste like. But I can, in the back of my mind, say it's possible. Yeah.
That was Jeezy. He's performing his own Nutcracker Suite in Las Vegas on December 19th and 21st. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You guys have amazing holidays, and I see y'all there. Planet Hollywood, pull up.
Why they call it on the snow? Cause that boy went polar. I can see it in his face. Yeah, that boy Minnesota. Soldier rag, yeah, that's when I'm in the know ya. Selling that white girl, Tony Montola. I just put a fool and a baby in a stroller. All yellow fox with an arm and a shoulder. Got 20 of them left, yeah, I'm trying to make my quota.
Kick, 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 kick. The Rockettes are celebrating their 100th anniversary. And recently, Rockette hopefuls from across the country lined up for an open call audition in New York City. NPR's Jennifer Venasco went to Radio City Music Hall to meet them.
They came from far.
Naples, Florida.
Honolulu, Hawaii.
They came from Paris, actually. That's where I'm living right now.
In near.
I live on 50th, so I just walked down.
All with one hope.
Being a Rockette has been my dream, like, ever since I can remember.
That's Reese Daly. She's 18. She's first in line today.
Yes, I am. I'm super excited.
And it's her first time auditioning. She's originally from Bozeman, Montana. Behind her is Alyssa Gallagher. She's 28 and from Pittsburgh. This is her 10th try.
The whole journey has been long, but I've been patient and I'm continuing to go for my dream.
They go through security, check in. They're given numbers to attach to their fronts, like a marathon, and start stretching on the floor of the lobby, which has chandeliers and a gold leaf ceiling. John D. Rockefeller wanted Radio City Music Hall to be so grand, even Great Depression audiences would come to a show. And it is. It opened in 1932, but the Rockettes started earlier, in 1925 in St. Louis, Missouri. Here they are in the 1930 movie The King of Jazz. Listen close. They almost sound like one dancer. Adrienne Gibbons Ehlers is a theater and dance professor at Wittenberg University and a former Rockette.
They began as a company of 16 dancers, and they called them the Rockets.
That became 36 dancers.
To sort of be able to stretch across this giant stage of Radio City.
The dancing they do is particularly difficult. And Ehlers says, at the time, precision dancing was also cool and newfangled.
You know, these ideas of industrialization were really prevalent. And so how do we do things mechanically organized in unison? That was a novelty that was really interesting and very awe-inspiring.
So much about entertainment and society has changed since 1925. We're not usually wowed by factory machines anymore. And it's hard to get people off their couches and into theaters. Ehlers says, yeah, that's the trick. The Rockettes need to keep routines people love for the nostalgia factor, like Parade of the Wooden Soldiers, which they've performed every year since it was introduced in 1933. But they have to balance that old stuff with something more contemporary.
It should feel like, hey, it's a party.
Like the combination the Rockettes hopefuls are trying out today.
5, 6, 7, and then everything comes out. Ha!
The Rockettes' big shows are the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and the Christmas Spectacular at Radio City Music Hall. That's the dream. And after they learn the routine, dancers enter the large rehearsal hall to audition in front of the director.
5, 6, 7, 8.
In groups of five, they turn, they kick, and after they've all gone, numbers are called.
68, 31, 1.
Which means these are the women 11, who get to come back tomorrow.
7, 8, 9, 10.
The Rockettes wouldn't give us an exact number of how many people made it through 3 days of auditions and callbacks. They said it's typically between 4% and 7%. But even those who make it aren't necessarily cast. Some of them will be invited to a development program. Some of them will be in the show. And some of them will be waiting online again next year. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from the Bagley Area Arts Collaborative, offering the community exhibits, workshops, and many events. More at BagleyArts.org. Northern Lights Nordic Ski Club has their annual cross-country ski swap Tuesday, December 16th at Ardent Bicycles in Grand Rapids from 3 to 6. If you have gear to sell or donate, you may drop it off Monday from 3 to 6 or after 9 on Tuesday morning. Ski Club members will assist with fittings